Hello, my name is Dr. Neil Young, and I'm the chief of the hematology branch of the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, which is part of the National Institutes of Health. I'm speaking to you from my office in Bethesda, Maryland, at the request of the Aplastic Anemia MDS Foundation, as part of their series of webcasts to educate patients and their families about various bone marrow failure diseases. And I'm speaking today on aplastic anemia, especially acquired aplastic anemia. Now, I've worked on this disease for probably over 20 years, all the time here at the National Institutes of Health. And my own background is not only to care for patients in clinical trials, but also to be in charge of a laboratory that does basic research in the area of bone marrow failure. And I've also conducted epidemiologic studies of aplastic anemia, especially in Asia. So I have a long-standing interest in this disease, which is a very serious disease for patients, but also a very interesting disease for doctors to treat and to study. So I want to speak to you about the disease in general, but because I'm speaking to patients and their families, I want to emphasize those aspects of aplastic anemia that are important to you. That has to do with what sort of problems the disease can cause to patients, what type of treatments are available, which doctors are specialists, how to choose an appropriate place to be treated, and what are the concerns that patients who have bone marrow failure generally have. Aplastic anemia is a very old disease from a hematologist's point of view. It was first described by a very famous pathologist named Paul Ehrlich well over 100 years ago. And he didn't treat a patient, but performed an autopsy on a young woman who died of aplastic anemia in Berlin in the 1880s. And what Ehrlich found remained the standard for the diagnosis of aplastic anemia for almost the entire 20th century. When Ehrlich performed the postmortem, he noted that unusually, this unfortunate young woman's bone marrow was empty. It was devoid of the cells that Ehrlich had recognized microscopically as being the precursors, the cells that generate blood cells, red blood cells, white cells, and platelets. And fundamentally, aplastic anemia is still diagnosed based on the appearance of the bone marrow. And that appearance is described as an absence, a hypoplasia, or aplasia of the cellular elements. And when one looks under the microscope at those cells, they're very easily identified as being the young forms of the red cells, white cells, and platelets that later are released into the circulation and serve a variety of functions. The red cells to carry oxygen, the white cells to combat infection, and the platelets to prevent and to assist when bleeding occurs. Now, Ehrlich's patient died probably of a combination of anemia, which was not treatable because red cell transfusions were still far in the future. She was infected because she had a high fever and she was also bleeding. And those are the major symptoms that affect patients and that bring them first to medical attention. Unfortunately, while aplastic anemia is an interesting and important disease, it's also rare. And patients certainly have no way of knowing that the symptoms that they're experiencing represent a specific disease. It's not like having a heart attack or developing diabetes, very common conditions that people are forewarned about in the newspapers. But aplastic anemia occurs in only a few new patients in a million individuals per year in the United States. Although it may be more common, probably is more common elsewhere in the world, and studies that we've done in Thailand, other studies that have been done in China suggest that aplastic anemia is perhaps two or three times more frequent in those countries and is in fact a disease that rivals acute leukemia in its frequency. So how do patients first suspect that they might have a hematologic problem that turns out to be aplastic anemia? The most common symptoms initially are fairly nonspecific. Patients often feel tired or short of breath, or they or a family member may notice that they're pale or lack their usual energy. Very young children can be cranky and somewhat apathetic. Older patients can actually develop symptoms that suggest that they might be having a heart attack. The second most common set of symptoms have to do with bleeding. This is almost never massive hemorrhage. It's usually nuisance type bleeding. bleeding gums, nosebleeds that never occurred before, very frequently easy bruising or the appearance of little red spots, especially over the lower part of the legs, which we call petechiae and represent very small hemorrhages into the skin. Infrequently, patients also will become infected, but that's actually relatively unusual. Most patients, especially in the United States and in developed countries, will seek medical care when they either note themselves not feeling well due to the anemia or develop bleeding symptoms. How does the doctor know to make a diagnosis of aplastic anemia, and what are the other diagnostic considerations? Well, the disease is almost always first suspected based on a blood count. Blood counts are easy to obtain. They're part of a routine evaluation. And when a blood count is typically done in a patient with aplastic anemia, all of the circulating blood elements are usually low. That means that the patient is anemic. We measure that looking at the hemoglobin. That's the concentration of this protein, which is present in red blood cells and which carries oxygen in the blood. The normal hemoglobin in an adult might be between 12 and 14 or 15. In patients who are suffering symptoms of anemia, the hemoglobin will be low, 6, 7, maybe 9 or 10 in an older person is enough to provoke the occurrence of symptoms. The platelet count is typically over 140 or 150,000, depending on the laboratory. Patients with aplastic anemia will frequently have very low platelet counts, 10,000, 15,000, lower, sometimes a bit higher, 30 or 40,000, depending on the severity of the disease. The white blood count, a normal value would be about 5 or 6,000. Patients with aplastic anemia will have a white count of 1,000 or 2,000. And what's especially low within the white blood cell compartment are the neutrophils, the granulocytes that are responsible for combating bacterial infection. So this is pancytopenia. That's the technical term, meaning that all the blood counts are low. Occasionally, patients will have a well-preserved platelet or a well-preserved white blood count, but almost always all the blood counts are depressed to some extent. That doesn't mean that the patient has aplastic anemia, and there are other causes of low blood counts. These are diseases that are often related to aplastic anemia, such as myelodysplasia, paroxysmal nocturnal hemoglobinuria. Even leukemia can occasionally present with very low blood counts without any evidence of leukemia in the blood. So making the diagnosis requires obtaining a bone marrow. Many of the patients watching this film will know what a bone marrow requires. A needle is placed through the skin and under the bone, usually the bone in the hip, and a core biopsy, the actual bone and the marrow is removed, as well as suction is applied to through the needle, and the bone marrow cells are aspirated into a syringe. They're smeared onto a slide and can be examined microscopically. In aplastic anemia, the bone marrow is very readily interpreted because all the normal cells that are responsible for blood cell production are absent or very much reduced. And the bone marrow overall just shows fat. Fat's present in the bone marrow normally, but in an aplastic bone marrow, almost the entire specimen will show fat. So the diagnosis is relatively straightforward. And it's also usually not difficult to distinguish aplastic anemia from MDS, because in most patients with MDS, there are sufficient cells. You see cells that are producing blood, but they look abnormal. There may be abnormal cells present, or the cells that should be maturing in a specific way, have a specific appearance, look dysplastic. They look as if they're not undergoing maturation normally. And of course, in leukemia, we see the leukemic blasts that are the sign of this particular hematologic disease. In younger people, it's also important to exclude a diagnosis of Fanconi anemia. The bone marrow can appear exactly the same as in acquired aplastic anemia, but special tests are done in the peripheral blood that allow us to say whether the Fanconi anemia defect in DNA repair is present in a child. And that's an important test to do in a younger person. There are also now genetic assays that allow us to distinguish between some types of inherited aplastic anemia and the acquired form of aplastic anemia. Most of the time, when a patient presents with aplastic anemia, there's no family history. There's no knowledge on the part of the patient of this disease. This is one of the more frightening aspects of aplastic anemia. It's a serious, often life-threatening blood disease, and the patient knows nothing and has heard nothing about this disease previously, partly because it's so rare. And that makes it important for patients to become educated as to what treatments are available and what type of care they will require and what their probability of responding to treatment and of living a normal life actually is. Most patients, when a diagnosis of aplastic anemia is either suspected or actually confirmed by a bone marrow, are in the hands of a hematologist, a doctor who is specialized in diseases of the blood. Unfortunately, most hematologists don't have a large experience with aplastic anemia because it is so infrequent a disease. And many patients at that stage are faced with the necessity of finding a specialist or a special institution that has a large experience and often clinical trials in the treatment of aplastic anemia. That's a problem. The second problem is actually deciding on what type of treatment they will find appropriate for their particular disease. The Aplastic Anemia MDS International Foundation makes the strong recommendation, with which I heartily concur, that patients with aplastic anemia at an early stage, soon after their diagnosis, find a physician or a center with experience in treating this specific disease. And they have on their website a number of potential places for patients to seek care that are convenient for geographical or other purposes. And going to such a center puts the patient in the best position to both obtain care and also to make a decision about the type of treatment that's best for them. So what are the therapies? What are the ways that physicians now treat aplastic anemia? Well, the treatment is based to some extent on experience, meaning that things have been tried, medications or procedures have been tried in the past that have worked. And even if it's not entirely understood why they do work, they're still advocated. There also is a much better understanding of aplastic anemia now, we would hope, compared to when Ehrlich was performing his autopsy over a century ago. And in most patients with aplastic anemia, we understand that the disease is fundamentally due to a loss of the hematopoietic stem cells, those cells that are responsible for the production of the red cells, white cells, and platelets. These cells have been destroyed, and that's the reason that the bone marrow appears empty and the reason that all the blood counts are low. We also understand that in most patients with aplastic anemia, this destructive process is almost certainly due to the immune system, to cells, T cells especially, that are special types of lymphocytes that combat infection, that have turned, for not clear reasons, have turned on the body and specifically killed, in a very efficient, unfortunately efficient fashion, have killed the stem cells. In this way, aplastic anemia actually resembles other human diseases that are also mediated by the immune system, and which result in the destruction of an organ. And some of these diseases are more familiar to you and to the general public. These are diseases like multiple sclerosis, where the same types of T cells have attacked cells of the nervous system and lead to neurologic symptoms, to ulcerative colitis, which is an immune-mediated process in which the colon is attacked. And there's chronic inflammation and problems with colitis, to more localized diseases like uveitis, which affects the eye. And even in diabetes in childhood, the current thinking is that children develop diabetes because their T cells specifically attack those cells in the pancreas that produce insulin. So aplastic anemia is not so strange in the context of these other human diseases. And we've learned from those diseases, and we hope that the physicians who treat them have learned from aplastic anemia, that the application of specific drugs, and in some instances the replacement of the organs, is effective in either preventing further damage and allowing regeneration, or providing, in fact, a new organ. In aplastic anemia, there is also conservative treatment. And conservative treatment means taking care of the low blood counts. And in almost all instances, it's conservative treatment that must be applied first to the patient. So conservative treatment is easy to understand. If a patient is anemic, providing red cells in the form of a transfusion is an obvious solution to the anemia, even if it's only temporary. In a patient who has completely stopped producing red cells, 1 unit of blood per week, usually given as 2 units of blood every 2 weeks, is sufficient to replace the bone marrow's function in the production of red cells. So patients usually can maintain a reasonable hemoglobin, meaning a level of red cells that's adequate for them to do all of their activities, including in many instances some form of exercise to allow them to remain in condition. We can also replace platelets, although these are somewhat less conveniently administered and also, unfortunately, much more expensive. And in general, a platelet transfusion per week is adequate to prevent bleeding symptoms, and should severe bleeding occur, platelets can be provided to stop that bleeding. White cells are more of a difficulty, and although there is such a thing as a white cell transfusion, it's not convenient to either obtain white cells or to give them frequently enough, which would probably be daily, to maintain an adequate level of white cells. So white cells are the single cell that we worry about the most in patients with aplastic anemia because they're the most difficult to either replace or to stimulate to levels that are adequate for infection. So at a minimum, a patient with aplastic anemia can be transfused with red blood cells, transfused with platelets, and if the neutrophil count or granulocyte count is very low, to have infections addressed immediately, meaning that fever or even local infection or just a general sense of not well-being should bring a patient with a low neutrophil count to a physician who will then evaluate the patient and determine whether antibiotics should be administered almost always in a hospital and administered intravenously on the possibility that these symptoms represent a serious infection. Now, obviously, transfusions and intermittent antibiotics are not a solution long-term for most patients, especially patients who have severe aplastic anemia. So there is a distinction that I want to talk about between the degrees of aplastic anemia. It develops that over the long term, the only important prognostic feature in a patient who's presenting with aplastic anemia is the level of the blood counts. Age, what was suspected as being the cause of aplastic anemia, ethnicity, sex, all of those are really of no great importance. What's most crucial is how low the blood counts actually are. And a variety of criteria have been developed that are good predictors for those patients who, in fact, can be supported by transfusions and have a good prospect of living relatively normally, even for many years, and patients whose disease absolutely requires treatment early on because the possibility of a poor outcome, meaning death or severe complications such as infection or hemorrhage, are much higher. And these blood count criteria are based on specific levels. So patients with less than 20,000 platelets, for example, or less than 500 neutrophils are in general in the category of severe aplastic anemia. Patients with severe aplastic anemia should have some type of definitive therapy. And in general, there are two major definitive therapies for severe aplastic anemia. The first is a stem cell transplant. The stem cells can be provided by doing a harvest of bone marrow, or more frequently, by collecting stem cells from the peripheral blood after stimulation of the donor with a drug called granulocyte colony stimulating factor. When is transplant best applied? Well, every child should be evaluated for the possibility of transplant because the results with stem cell transplant in children are excellent. And now almost all young children, if there is an appropriate donor available, have probably a greater than 85 or 90% chance of an excellent outcome as a result of a stem cell transplant. What type of donor do we need to do a transplant? Most transplants now that are undertaken at the outset of aplastic anemia are from a sibling, a brother or sister, who is HLA matched, who is histocompatible with the patient. The chance of a brother or sister being histocompatible is 25%. So large families, there's a good opportunity to find an HLA matched donor. Single children, obviously there's no possibility of finding a sibling, And patients with small families, the probabilities are obviously low. Older patients also can be transplanted. Exactly to what age is not entirely clear, but certainly young adults do well with transplant, although not as well as children. And even older patients, as old as me, patients in their 50s or 60s have been successfully transplanted. But the complications of transplant increase with age and become quite serious in individuals who are in late middle age and certainly in elderly patients. So in general, older patients will look carefully at the alternative to stem cell transplant, which is immunosuppression. Now remember that I told you earlier that we think that aplastic anemia is due to immune cell destruction of bone marrow stem cells. So a stem cell transplant treats both of these problems. It replaces the stem cells, but it also replaces the immune system. With immunosuppression, there's no requirement to replace the stem cells. Instead, the principle is to reduce or eliminate those immunologic cells, those T cells, that are doing the destructive work in the bone marrow and allow the stem cells in the marrow to recover, to produce more stem cells and to produce the differentiated cells, the red cells, white cells, and platelets. Now, immunosuppression and bone marrow transplant have never been compared head-to-head in any study. But there are many studies that suggest that immunosuppression and stem cell transplant can result in roughly equivalent outcomes overall, although one type of treatment or another may be better for certain types of patients. I've already mentioned that children do so well with stem cell transplant if a sibling donor is available that they should be transplanted if the opportunity is there. On the other hand, a 70 or 80-year-old patient with aplastic anemia, especially if the neutrophils are not severely affected, will always do better with immunosuppression. Older patients in general do better with immunosuppression than they do with stem cell transplantation because of the complications that age introduces to the stem cell transplant process. It can be a difficult decision in patients in between as to whether to go first to stem cell transplant or immunosuppression. However, most patients don't have the option of a stem cell transplant only because they don't have a sibling who is available who is HLA matched. So immunosuppression is more generally applied to aplastic anemia than can be stem cell transplant. There also are, in countries outside the United States and even in our own country, financial barriers that can exist to undertaking a stem cell transplant. How do we do immunosuppression? The standard treatment is a combination of a drug called ATG, or antithymocyte globulin. Antithymocyte globulin is actually not a chemical. It's a collection of antibodies obtained from horses or rabbits that have been immunized with lymphocytes from human beings. These animals produce antibodies to the lymphocytes, and when these antibodies are given to the patient in an infusion into a vein, they will reduce the number of lymphocytes, especially T cells, and function as an immunosuppressant. A drug that's also now almost always given to patients with aplastic anemia in combination with ATG is cyclosporine. This is a chemical compound that doesn't destroy T cells, but blocks their activities. And there are other drugs as well that are less frequently used that have the same type of immunosuppressive effect. And in fact, developing new immunosuppressive regimens is one of the things that we do at NIH in an effort to improve outcomes and to reduce the to improve the safety of doing immunosuppression in patients with aplastic anemia. So to summarize, a patient with severe aplastic anemia has the option of conservative treatment, meaning transfusions of red cells and platelets, and of the use of antibiotics for fever and other signs of infection. But a patient with severe aplastic anemia should seek some type of definitive therapy to improve their bone marrow function and to avoid the complications and the transfusion requirements of severe pancytopenia. And those options are stem cell transplant and immunosuppression. In a child, stem cell transplant is always preferred, and an HLA-matched sibling must be sought. In older patients, immunosuppression and stem cell transplants are both effective, and the decision as to how to treat the patient depends on their age and their blood counts and other factors. There are other therapies that have also been developed for aplastic anemia that are not as well accepted or as generally accepted, and we should speak a little bit about those. First, I'm not an enthusiast, and I think most physicians are not enthusiastic about homeopathic or herbal or other remedies that have not undergone some type of testing in academic centers in the United States, in Europe, or Asia, but in some academic centers. And I think patients run a very serious risk of harm when they undertake these alternative remedies in the hopes of avoiding the complications of medical care or stem cell transplant. And I think patients are at risk of death, of serious infection, of bleeding, if they attempt to temporize when their blood counts are low by these seemingly innocuous types of therapies. Physicians have other forms of immunosuppression that have not been as well tried, and patients sometimes are enlisted into studies of these. I think that the answer as to what is the optimal immunosuppressive regimen remains uncertain, and that is a major source, subject of research at NIH and at other institutions. I think patients can be optimistic that better immunosuppressive drug therapies, which are being developed for many reasons, not specifically for aplastic anemia, but for example to improve the outcomes of organ transplants and for other autoimmune diseases, are going to be effective in patients with aplastic anemia. And we know from our own experience and from the experience of the large European centers that often a second or even a third course of some type of immunosuppression can rescue a patient whose blood counts have not responded to a single course of immunosuppression. So there's every reason for optimism in approaching treatment of aplastic anemia in the hands of physicians who are competent and who are well informed as to the alternatives available. Also on the transplant side, there is increasingly better success with the use of alternative donors. So for example, patients, especially children, can now receive stem cell transplants that are not from a sibling who is HLA matched. Some of those sources would include HLA matched donors outside the family. There are large donor registries now, such as the National Marrow Donor Program, with many tens or even hundreds of thousands of patients, of donors HLA types available. The search for such a donor is relatively easy to undertake using the computers available, and donors can be identified, and unrelated transplants are undertaken quite frequently. Almost never as the first treatment, but often in children especially who have failed one or more courses of immunosuppression. And these types of unrelated transplants also are being applied to younger adults and even older adults with increasing success. So again, reason for optimism on the side of stem cell transplant. Let me describe specifically what type of outcomes a patient can anticipate going through a stem cell transplant or immunosuppressive therapy. I'm speaking specifically now of patients with severe aplastic anemia who have those very low blood counts that I told you about earlier. So I told you that a child with aplastic anemia who's transplanted from a completely matched brother or sister has about an 85 or 90% chance of having the sibling's bone marrow grow back, reconstitute the blood counts, and go on to lead a hematologically and in general normal life. So those are the very best outcomes that we can anticipate. Adults have a somewhat lower long-term survival. This is the phrase that's used to describe outcomes not at 6 months or 1 year, but at 5 years or 10 years. So adults who undergo bone marrow transplant, at least the adults who underwent these in the 1990s and in the early part of the current century, probably have a 75 or 80% opportunity of long-term survival. That's young adults. For older adults, meaning patients perhaps over the age of 40, that number is going to be somewhat lower, perhaps on the order of 65 or 70%. Older patients, unfortunately, may not be free of some of the complications of bone marrow transplant, most notably chronic graft versus host disease. Immunosuppression, the results are variable from institution to institution, but overall, about 65 to 70% of patients will respond to the first round of immunosuppression. That means that their blood counts will improve so that they don't require transfusion. Blood counts may not be normal, but they're high enough so that the patient is not at risk for infection and doesn't suffer symptoms of bleeding or anemia. Unfortunately, with immunosuppression, a single round of, for example, ATG plus cyclosporine may not be adequate to maintain the blood counts indefinitely. And a large proportion of patients, if they don't relapse back to the original pancytopenia, will still require more therapy. In other words, they may be on cyclosporine and taking that for some number of years, or in some instances require a second or even third round of ATG for their blood counts to be sustained and to be high. But I would stress that patients are often without symptoms, feeling well, back to work on very low doses of cyclosporine, even 3 or 4 years after immunosuppression. And relapse defined as the requirement for more immunotherapy is not equivalent to relapse as, for example, with blood cancers, in which the prognosis is clearly much poorer. I think that for other types of treatment, and these other therapies would include, for example, combinations of growth factors, the use of male hormones, the use of alternative types of immunosuppression, there's much less data available, and it's much harder to come to conclusions as to long-term outcomes. How does a patient know where to be treated? And this is a very difficult problem for a physician making recommendations to patients. I think that patients have much greater autonomy and are much better educated. The fact that you're watching this now on the internet is evidence of the availability of fairly sophisticated medical information to patients. But as is a common complaint, there can be too much information and its authority can also be suspect. So patients often are faced with the dilemma of many different institutions which may appear to be competing for them in their treatment. And it's not easy to make simple recommendations. I think patients, as I said earlier, should always seek to be cared for at an institution or by a physician or team that is experienced with their disease. And obviously, we here at NIH have a lot of experience, but so do many other medical centers in the United States and in Europe. And I think for standard care, patients who are treated at one of these large institutions will receive roughly equivalent types of therapy. It's not necessary to go to Europe to find specific treatments. The Food and Drug Administration is not blocking any magical drugs in the United States that we are desperate to obtain. It's not necessary to go to Asia to find specific herbal remedies. These are more likely to delay therapy or to, in fact, cause problems based on the uncertainty of their constitution than patients often suspect. Stem cell transplantation also is relatively standardized throughout the developed world, and stem cell transplant results are roughly equivalent at major academic centers in the United States, in Europe, and even in various parts of Asia where large numbers of patients with aplastic anemia may be transplanted. I would like to tell you a bit about the treatment program at the NIH. As I told you at the outset, we've had the experience of several decades of caring for patients, many thousands of patients with aplastic anemia and with related syndromes like MDS and PNH and pure red cell aplasia, other rarer forms of bone marrow failure. The NIH is unusual because care here is free of charge, with the understanding that all patients are entering into clinical protocols. That means that there's an agreement between us as treating, but also research physicians, and the patients. There's a mutual understanding that we are providing advanced treatment that we believe will be at least as good as standard care, but the patients are asked to undergo some research, meaning that, for example, another drug is added or the regimen is varied, in the hopes of improving outcomes, but without necessarily the assurance that the risk of the change in therapy will necessarily benefit the individual patient. But it is this way that we're actually able to ultimately improve the outcomes for patients with aplastic anemia. And for example, at NIH, we were the American center that showed that the addition of cyclosporine had a major impact on outcomes with immunosuppressive therapy for patients with severe aplastic anemia. And our hope for the future is that either the addition of new immunosuppressive drugs to the ATG cyclosporine regimen, changing the way cyclosporine is given, for example, administering cyclosporine for more prolonged periods of time than the usual 6 months, or even the introduction of new, less toxic, but quite powerful immunosuppressive drugs will be effective in patients with aplastic anemia. I'll mention as an example that we've shown recently that patients who have moderate aplastic anemia often respond to a monoclonal antibody immunosuppressant. This is a designed antibody that only attacks and kills those T cells that are activated. It's very easy to administer. There's almost no toxicity to the patient, and about 50% of our patients with moderate disease have become transfusion independent. This is the type of outcome that we're obviously striving for using less toxic but more effective therapies in patients with severe aplastic anemia. So to conclude, I want to stress again my own sense of optimism as to the outcomes in patients with aplastic anemia, even of the most severe form, to let patients know that the U.S. government and that we here at NIH and many individuals who are supported by the NIH outside of Bethesda are working hard and are extremely interested in aplastic anemia and improving the probability of a response to treatment and of the survival of patients with this disease for many, many years, and that there is reason for optimism on the part of every patient and their family that our therapies are much better now than they were even when I began to work in this field, that most patients now survive with this disease in contrast to almost all patients dying with the disease in the 1970s and 1980s, that even patients who don't respond to immunosuppression or stem cell transplant have available to them excellent supportive care, red cells, platelets, growth factors to help with white cells, and other treatments, and that I think within the next decade, our therapies will improve in every respect, and the very great majority of patients with aplastic anemia will do very well indeed.